This week on Pirate Party Radio, libelous Lincoln goes to court in Canada. Courts rule the FCC has no say in net neutrality, and the digital economy bill passes in the UK. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 23, for Thursday, April 8th, 2010.
It's about a proposed new law called the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, or IMMI. It's not the law there yet, but it's already caught the attention of journalists, civil rights organizations, and media all over the world. The idea behind IMMI is simple, but it's ambitious. Bring together some of the most progressive media laws from many different countries to create one holistic law that will position Iceland at the forefront of the battle to protect journalists, whistleblowers, and their sources from repressive libel laws.
Does he not think that this bill is in danger of criminalizing large numbers of imaginative young people and education establishments who frequently share material on the internet, frequently use it as a form of creative expression? Are we going to kill all that off and cut people off as a result of this bill?
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture, knowledge, control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. A couple of intro clips off the top. The first one was a clip of Jeremy Corbyn from last night's vote on the digital economy bill, and we're going to get into that a little bit later, and it's called Creativity is the Enemy. That's just the beginning of the clip. It goes into a kind of a remix of the debate, a little bit of it, and they put it to a song. It's interesting. Go check it out. I've got the link in the Pirate Party Radio forums. And the second one is a clip about the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative at IMMI.is, putting together a collective place for journalists to post and host their sites in Iceland, sort of a safe haven for journalism. Very interesting concept. Hopefully that goes through, gives a little bit more freedom for people to disseminate ideas about maybe oppressive regimes around the world that don't normally allow information to be posted in their host countries. We've got an incoming message from David Gilson. He says, there's been a lot of talk about password management on the show lately. Privacy is very important. My take on the subject is don't store your passwords, calculate them. Further details on how to dynamically generate strong passwords on my blog. And I've got given a link to his blog there. And an excerpt from his blog says, a while ago, I listened to Floss Weekly interviewing Eric Jung from the Foxy Proxy Project. During the interview, his involvement with a free and open source project called Password Maker was mentioned. Password Maker works by generating a cryptographic hash of both the domain of the website you're logging into and a master password of your choosing, thus creating a different piece of pseudo-random text for every website you use. There are lots more settings so that you can finely tune what goes into the password, but don't worry about those just now. To put it simply, you never have to find or recover your passwords, because they're never stored. They're just generated for you when you need access to them. The best way to use Password Maker is in the form of a Firefox add-on. However, if you're away from home or whatever, there's an online version and a mobile browser version, which you can even install on your own website if you have one. The best security aspect of this is that your master password isn't stored. It's the hashing algorithm, and the hashing algorithm is already open, so there's nothing to hack. If any one of your site's passwords is compromised, it's easy to create a new one by using a new master password. Furthermore, so that you're not having to remember all the different master passwords for different sites, I would take one compromised password as an excuse to change all of your passwords. Changing your passwords is inconvenient when you have a lot of accounts on the web, but Master Password Maker makes it easier to get into the habit, especially with the Firefox add-on. The recent news pushed me into finally doing this. Although I've been putting it off due to the fear of trying to make it work with my mobile browser, although thanks to Opera Mini 5 now supporting text selection and tab browsing, this makes the mobile browser version a viable method for advanced password management on your phone. So take a look at this, because the more I think about it, the more it makes sense. Because a lot of the other alternatives that were mentioned during other shows to keep your privacy and keep your passwords stored had a master password, but they also stored a database of passwords of your choosing. Now, because this is an open source project and people can analyze the source and check out the security of this program called Password Maker, gives a little bit more peace of mind to people wanting to use it. And it doesn't store your passwords, it makes generates these passwords. It's not a random generator, it's based on your master password and the website put together. It generates a password from those that doesn't change unless you change your master password. So from the webpage, it says you provide Password Maker two pieces of information, a master password, that one single password you like, and the URL of the website requiring a password. Through the magic of one-way hash algorithms, Password Maker calculates a message digest, also known as a digital fingerprint, which can be used as your password for the website. Although one-way hash algorithms have a number of interesting characteristics, the one capitalized by Password Maker is that the resulting fingerprint password does not reveal anything about the input that was used to generate it. In other words, if someone has one or more of your generated passwords, it's computationally infeasible for him to derive your master password or to calculate your other passwords. And he says computationally infeasible because it's not impossible to get your other passwords, but it's just not really possible with the computational devices that people have access to unless they have a large... unless they have access to a massive, massive powerful computer or set of computers. And I'm pretty sure there's more information on their website about how much computational power would be needed to generate those passwords from one or more of the passwords that somebody might have. So that's very interesting, something to check out as an alternative for passwords, so you don't have to memorize any passwords except for your master password. And it's very available by being on websites. You can take the program with you, you can have it as your add-on. I'm going to definitely check this out as a very easy solution where you only have to memorize one password for all your websites and you don't have to store any of your passwords anywhere. They're not stored. Very interesting. Thank you very much, David Gilson. Excellent recommendation for the password problem that's out there. If you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form, and you can get a hold of me. In pirate news, the big news this week, copyright and free speech news from the UK, the Digital Economy Bill has passed, and this was first sent in by David Gilson as well. He lives in the UK. The controversial bill was passed by MPs last night, 189 votes to 47, following its third reading in the House of Commons after 2 hours of debate. It has been processed so speedily as it is being pushed through in the political wash-up process, which takes place between an election being called and Parliament being dissolved. However, many companies and organizations affected by the bill, which has caused ripples across the technology world, most notably because its proposals regarding the suspension of repeat file sharers' internet connections, and also the measures that would allow politicians to block websites which contained pirated material without primary legislation, has criticized this rushed process. TalkTalk's Director of Regulation, Andrew Heaney, said the way in which the bill is passed through the House of Commons has been undemocratic. It's a bad day for democracy, bordering on disgraceful, when such a complicated bill, which could have negatively affected many people, gets shoved through the Commons so quickly. It's an appalling indictment of our democracy that this can happen with a bill which requires a great deal of understanding. Surely our MPs need to scrutinize the bill for a longer period than 2 days, and take some time over the process like the Lords did. The ISP has spoken out against the bill's proposed measures for dealing with persistent file sharers since its inception. It has no issue with sending out warning letters to internet pirates as long as the letter is in an educational tone, but refuses to be forced by the government to comply with technical measures such as capped bandwidth or broadband disconnection. The company said TalkTalk will continue to battle against these oppressive proposals. They will require secondary legislation before they can be implemented. After the election, we will resume highlighting the substantial dangers inherent in the proposals. In the meantime, we can stand by our pledges to our customers. Unless we are served with a court order, we will never surrender a customer's detail to rights holders. We are the only major ISP to have taken this stance, and we will maintain it. If we are instructed to disconnect an account due to an alleged copyright infringement, we will refuse to do so and tell the rights holders. It will also lobby the government to reduce the percentage ISPs will be forced to pay to cover the cost of the warning letters, which is currently stands at 25% from ISPs and 75% to be covered by the rights holders. The bill has also faced criticisms from Internet Freedom Campaigners, the open rights group, whose executive director Jim Killock said, "This is an utter disgrace. This is an attack on everyone's right to communicate, work, and gain an education. Politicians have shown themselves to be incompetent and completely out of touch with an entire generation's values." Killock has also been responsible for spearheading a campaign over the last week, which saw over 20,000 voters write the local MPs lobbying against the bill being rushed through in its current form. The Pirate Party UK expressed similar concerns about the internet pirate curbing measures, saying the law will not stop copyright infringement. It will simply drive it behind encryption and obfuscation techniques, and will effectively criminalize over 6 million Britain's children, teens, and adults alike, all for protectionist attempt to protect a dying industry. Parliament does not need to protect or even encourage analog-age business models if it wants a digital Britain. They must either engage with new technology or suffer the consequences, as with any other business. This is an adapt-or-die situation. The struggling sectors of the content industries have failed to conform to the digital revolution and should not be rescued for clinging to their antiquated business model. Former Labour Minister Tom Watson and the Labour MP Kate Hui are concerned that the bill would be pushed into law by a stitch-up between the leaders of the three main parties. Watson said he was worried that the innocent internet users will be caught in the crossfire by the bill's internet piracy curbing clause by simply living in the same building as infringers. There might be a deal with the Tory front bench and the Liberal Democrats front bench, but there are 20,000 people who have taken the time to email their MPs about this in the last 7 days alone. One clause which was dropped from the bill was number 43, which would have allowed organizations to use or digitize for the public use orphan works whose copyright owners can no longer be found. Despite the removal of this clause being welcomed by many rights holders, especially photographers who feared uniquely a disadvantage, it has also prompted further criticism of the MPs from libraries, archives, and galleries. Toby Bainton, Secretary for the Society of College National and University Libraries, said, "We're very disappointed about the abandonment of the orphan works provision in the bill. The digital age allows us to make these very interesting works, many of which are old political pamphlets, photographs, and films, which would be so useful for many people's research, more widely available through digitization, and now we're not be able to obtain a license to do so." As the bill originated with the House of Lords, it has now gone back to the Lords today for a final approval, which is expected to get through as this procedure is largely viewed as a formality. After this stage, the bill will have completed all of its parliamentary process and is expected to receive royal assent before passing into law. Now I'm going to go on to read what the Pirate Party of the UK has said. There was a clip of it, a section of it that I read out there, but I'm going to read it in full here. Today marks a somber day for Britain's digital future as members of Parliament appeared from the woodwork to force through fatally flawed and disturbingly draconian piece of legislation. despite wide-ranging objections from all corners of the chamber, both over the content of the bill and the manner in which it was passed. The majority of MPs were reportedly under a deeply inappropriate three-line whip, meaning any revolt held the most severe punishments, effectively forcing a vote in favor despite it being one of the most contentious bills of recent years. Fewer than 50 MPs defied the front benches to vote against the bill. Members of the Pirate Party joined thousands of people from around the world in watching and commenting on the debate and were left profoundly disappointed, although unsurprised, with the outcome. Despite both opposition parties pledging to do their job by opposing the controversial aspects of the bill, neither put up a significant fight, with most of the debate being between the front and back benches of the Labour Party, with the shadow ministers more interested in scoring political points than debating the issues at hand. A very poor showing from the Liberal Democrats, contrary to the assurances that they would block the bill at every opportunity. Graham Lambert, Pirate Party UK candidate for Bury North, said, "It was painfully obvious to anyone watching the broadcast from Parliament this evening that any MP that only turned up for the divisions and not for the debate does not care about the views of their constituents, does not care about democracy, and does not care about the future of Britain's digital economy." The Minister for Digital Britain, Stephen Timms, appeared to spend much of his time on the floor delaying debate and refusing to answer questions put to him, instead relying on the party whips to force the vote through, essentially ignoring the concerns raised by voters in their questions put to ministers, noted Mark Sims, Pirate Party UK candidate for Eastham. However, there have been a few glimmers of hope amid the moray of apathy for citizens' rights in the chamber tonight, in the shape of Labour MPs John Grogan, Austin Mitchell, Nick Palmer, Tom Watson, Conservative MP Bill Cash, and Liberal Democrat MP John Hemming, amongst others. These MPs not only listened to the electorate, but also to professionals, academics, and artists, and realized that the bill was, to quote Nick Palmer, Tom Watson, and Austin Mitchell, nothing short of a front bench stitch-up, and this is a bulldozer to democracy, and like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. The Pirate Party UK would also like to take this opportunity to applaud Tom Watson and the other valiant MPs who broke the three-line whip for having the passion and devotions to stand up for what they believe is right. If British politics were filled with more men like Mr. Watson and his colleagues, the country might never have been brought into this dire legislative situation in the first place. One thing can be made clear today: whether they realize it or not, many MPs support Pirate Party UK ideals, calling for non-commercial infringements to be exempt from the bill. John Hemming MP, Liberal Democrat, and surprisingly a member of the BPI, PRS, and Musicians Union, even called for a total review of copyright, while echoing many Pirate Party freedom and speech policies, and making well-conceived technical points on the flaws of the bill. The law will not stop copyright infringement. It will simply drive it behind encryption and obfuscation techniques, and will effectively criminalize over 6 million Britons, children, teens, and adults alike, all for the protectionist attempt to protect a dying industry. Parliament does not need to protect or even encourage analog-age business models if it wants a digital Britain. They must either engage with new technology or suffer the consequences. As with any other business, this is an adapt-or-die situation. The struggling sectors of the content industry have failed to conform to the digital revolution and should not be rescued for clinging to their antiquated business models. It has been made abundantly clear tonight that the main parties in Parliament cannot be trusted to maintain and protect the rights of citizens and small businesses online in the 21st century. Therefore, it's time to vote for one that can. It's time to vote pirate. Now, you can watch the full debate and the vote. I've linked to it in the Pirate Party Radio forums, and I've also linked to a list of who voted in what way for the digital economy bill, and also a link so you can write to your MP if you're in the UK expressing how you felt about how they voted, whether it's for or against. If they voted against it, then you can congratulate them and thank them for doing that, or if they voted for the digital economy bill, you can express your concern of why you are opposed to this. It's a law that, like the Pirate Party UK said, that is not going to be effective. All it does is criminalize people who are doing what comes naturally to them, non-commercial infringement of copyright, which is as common as breathing air nowadays for people around the world. They're brought up in this new age of new generation of not understanding this, not understanding why people are so protectionist against sharing information. And it's very sad that this has passed, and hopefully something can be done about this, or they can be shown the error of their ways once they use this digital economy bill in the ways that are not intended, once the corporations come out and start bringing shutting down people's internet connections, once the a number of maybe high-profile Britons get kicked off the internet, people in power, maybe then somebody will sit up and take notice of how dangerous this bill can be to the welfare and education of Britain's population. How much the internet is being used on a daily basis, and how dire it is that people have access to the information that is now available on the internet. It's like going back a couple of hundred years and denying people the access to read books, the access to go to a library and access information. It's akin to that, and people don't understand how ingrained the internet is in people's everyday life, and being deprived of this is going to have a severe effect on the education of Britain's youth and the access to even the government facilities, being able to access and get information and be a normal person in society in Britain. A very sad day for the UK, and I hope something can be done, or something is brought to light and shows how bad this actually is and how bad it's going to be once these supposed innocuous laws go into effect, where people don't think that it's going to be a large impact. The people that pushed it through don't think it's going to be a large impact on the national on the nation of Britain. So very sad. The next story, also very upsetting, out of the U.S. Net neutrality news from the U.S. It was ruled the FCC has no power to regulate net neutrality. This is sent in first by Mobile Diesel. I was inundated by people sending this in. The Federal Communications Commission does not have the legal authority to slap net neutrality regulations on internet providers, a federal appeals court ruled Tuesday. A three-judge panel in Washington, D.C. unanimously tossed out the FCC's August 2008 cease and desist order against Comcast, which had taken measures to slow BitTorrent transfers before voluntarily ending them earlier that year. Because the FCC has failed to tie its assertion of regulatory authority to an actual law enacted by Congress, the agency does not have the power to regulate an internet provider's network management practices, wrote Judge David Tattle of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Tuesday's decision could doom one of the signature initiatives that the FCC chairman Julius Genachowski, a Democrat, last October. Genachowski announced plans to begin drafting a formal set of net neutrality rules, even though Congress had not given the agency permission to do so. That push is opposed by Verizon and other broadband providers. Comcast welcomed the ruling in a statement that said, "Our primary goal was always to clear our name and reputation." The National Cable and Telecommunications Association, the cable industry's lobby group, elaborated by saying that Comcast and its other members will continue to embrace a free and open internet as the right policy. Supporters of net neutrality claim that the new internet regulations or laws are necessary to prevent broadband providers from restricting content or prioritizing one type of traffic over another. Broadband providers and many conservatives and free market groups, on the other hand, say that some of the proposed regulations would choke off new innovations and could even require an awarding email spam and telemedicine the identical priorities. Net neutrality proponents responded to Tuesday's ruling by saying that FCC should slap landline-style regulations on internet providers, which could involve price regulation, service quality controls, and technological mandates. The agency should immediately start a proceeding bringing internet access service back under some common carrier regulation. Public Knowledge's Gigi Sohn said, the Media Access Project said, without mentioning common carrier regulations directly, that the FCC must have the ability to protect the rights of internet users to access lawful content and services of their choice. In a statement on Tuesday, the FCC indicated that it was thinking along the same lines. The D.C. Circuit did not close the door to other methods for achieving this important end, the agency said. A spokeswoman declined to elaborate. Early reaction on Capitol Hill cleaved along party lines. Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the Texas senator and senior Republican on the Senate Commerce Committee, said, "It would be wrong to double down on excessive and burdensome regulations, and I hope the FCC chairman will now reconsider his decision to pursue expanded commission authority over broadband services." Representative Joe Barton, the Texas Republican, warned that the FCC should not reclassify broadband providers as common carriers. Representative Fred Upton, the Michigan Republican, added that such an action by the FCC would be illegal. Senator Orrin Hatch, the Utah Republican, called the decision good news for the future prosperity of the Internet. Representative Ed Markley, the Massachusetts Democrat who had drafted one of the unsuccessful net neutrality bills, said, "I encourage the FCC to take any actions necessary to ensure that consumers and competition are protected on the Internet." Markey noted that he reintroduced a similar legislation last summer. It has been stuck in a House subcommittee, even though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi once said there was an urgent need to enact it. Broadband providers have found allies among free market groups that worry that the FCC expanding become Internet Regulatory Commission. Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation wrote that if the agency deems everyone under the sun to be a common carrier, it would be regulatory World War III. Thomas Leonard, president of the Technology Policy Institute, said in an email that, contrary to what public knowledge claims, it is obvious that applying common carrier regulation to the broadband sector is regulating the Internet. To suggest otherwise makes no sense. So the debate really is between the ISPs don't want to be locked down with rules on how they operate because they think they'd be way too restrictive and they wouldn't be able to progress properly. And on the other side, the FCC is envisioning the ISPs that are going to go for a pay-for-play kind of thing where things get slow. If a large media conglomerate comes to an ISP, of which they own some of them, and says, our traffic should be given priority and all the other providers of media should be slowed down. So you should slow down YouTube because they present competition to our videos that are shown on our site. So you should slow them down because that's not gonna, we just don't like them. And they would have nothing to prevent them from doing that. They could slow down everything on the internet except for the stuff that they like or the people that pay them. Or, on the other hand, what the ISPs could do is slow down absolutely everything to a crawl on the internet and then start soliciting for people to pay them for, you know, places that if you want to be fast, you pay us. If Google wants to be fast, Google has to come to all the major ISPs and give them a bit of money to be fast on their networks. Now, people, the Republicans on the other side, the free market advocates are going to say, well, then somebody could just go to another ISP that does not do this. And it's a completely free and open market. But a lot of people, I think, would argue against that they really don't have a lot of choices in the markets that they live in. Say in a city, they have maybe one choice of, or one or two broadband choices, one over the high-speed telephone lines and one over cable. And really, there's no room for another market to come in there because everything is regulated, right? Everything is owned way, way back. Now, even if a new person comes into the market and wants to offer internet service to a town, they'll have to go and apply to get some uplink from a major ISP that's providing it to the area. Otherwise, they're going to have to fork out a huge amount of cash to be able to provide internet access to that town. So it's tricky, but I think really net neutrality is the way to go so that people, so that these ISPs can't, bow down to the wishes of the corporations. and slow down your internet access for you and me, and become really after it goes that way, it's going to become one big advertising scheme where everything is just comes to a crawl, and you're going to be have to pay for packages, or yeah, it could go the other way where the burden is put on not the end. Not like Google, that all the major providers of the internet access, but the customers, where everything is slow, and then you pay for a premium. You pay for websites that have video, or you pay extra for torrents, or you pay extra for music, or you pay extra for this and that when it's out there on the other end of the where the providers of this content is, and they're streaming it to the internet as fast as they want, but the other end's never going to get it because they're slowed down, artificially slowed down by the ISPs. So very troubling ruling. So right now the ISPs are free to do whatever they want and slow it down as much as they want. So keep an eye out and watch for artificial slowdowns on an ISP near you. If one page is going fast and the other one's going slow, you may want to look to this to understand why that's happening. In copyright news from the UK, anti-piracy lawyers vandalize Wikipedia page. This is sent in by DC. As mass file-sharing litigation lawyers go intercontinental, not everyone is proud to be associated with this type of work. Lawyers Tilly Bailey and Irvine in the UK have been hard at work this month editing large chunks of their own Wikipedia page in an attempt to hide their involvement and also earning themselves a copyright infringement warning. This week, Jeffrey Weaver, a lawyer for U.S. Copyright Group, proudly announced that the company would be bringing mass litigation model against BitTorrent users to the United States. And I mentioned this story, the mass litigation last week. We're creating a revenue stream and monetizing the equivalent of an alternative distribution channel, he unashamedly confirmed. This business model has been running ahead at full steam in Germany and the UK for some time now, as they do most of the work and are seen to do most of the perceived bullying of individuals ill-equipped to defend themselves. The lawyers operate these schemes have been singled out for most of the criticism. Tilly Bailey and Irvine TBI, the lawyers who just made their first steps into this business model in the UK, had a very stormy entrance. Within weeks, their activities have been noted negatively by the government and had their traditional 170-year-old company publicly connected with their porn industry customers. Of course, the antics of the TBI haven't gone unnoticed by the tech-savvy, who have been adding details of their involvement into these schemes to the company's Wikipedia page, as detailed below. Volume litigation. This is from the Wikipedia page. On March 1st, 2010, Lawyers Clement Jones criticized TBI's solicitors along with the firm ACS Law for tactics they employed when accusing people of copyright infringement. He called TBI solicitors new entrants into the Hall of Infamy and their activities an embarrassment to the rest of the creative rights industry. On 3rd of March, UK consumers' rights website Which reported complaints by people who have received letters by TBI solicitors accusing them of illegally sharing files of pornographic material that belongs to GoldenEye International. TBI solicitors threatened legal action against the letters recipients unless they paid £700 compensation within 14 days of the date of the letter. On March 9th, Which reported an undertaking by Lord Young that the government would keep a watch on ACS and TBI solicitors. In an attempt to remove this embarrassing information, a staff member, Tilly Bailey and Irvine, took direct action by deleting the entire section 10 days after Torrent Freak broke the news of their entrance to this business. So how do we know it was TBI doing the editing? Because they were smart enough to edit it from 195.153.132.204, the IP address registered to their company. Please do not remove sourced content from Wikipedia as you did with TBI solicitors. This is vandalism, wrote a Wikipedia admin to Tilly Bailey and Irvine. Furthermore, your IP address geolocates to Tilly Bailey and Irvine, which suggests that you have a conflict of interest in removing criticism of the firm from Wikipedia. I suggest that you familiarize yourself with that policy before editing this particular article any further, added the award-winning user R. Landman. The final embarrassment on the TBI talk page prompted another comment by R. Landman. Copyright problem. I've also removed a large chunk of text from the TBI solicitor's article that was copy and pasted from This Is Hartlepool website. This creates a potential copyright problem for Wikipedia. Torrent Freak has learned that Tilly Bailey and Irving has already dropped some of the cases against alleged infringers after they denied their accusations. We're not sure if the editing of their Wikipedia page means that they intend to move out of this business altogether, since thus far they have refused to answer any of our questions, but it would be a welcome move. So, some very ironic things happening in the copyright realm yet again of somebody taking people to... lawyer's firm sending out letters saying cease and desist your copyright infringement, but of course they're also found accused of copyright infringement, which shows that people just don't understand copyright infringement anymore. They don't understand how commonplace that supposed copyright infringement happens supposed fair use of copyright, fair use of copyrighted material. So even the lawyer firm doesn't understand what could be taking place when they copy a whole section of text from somebody else's website and puts it on Wikipedia's page. So how are they supposedly able to understand copyright infringements further than just sending out willy-nilly pieces of paper demanding money from people using data for non-commercial infringement uses? So it just goes to show you a little bit of what's happening out there and people's mindset and not understanding fully about what copyright is all about. In world privacy news, does ACTA kill online anonymity? With the full draft of ACTA leaked, lots of people have been highlighting the various lowlights found in the draft. Andrew Moshirina over at the Citizens Media Law Project has picked up on another one. If you read the draft, it appears to remove due process in revealing anonymous users. While other countries have viewed anonymity differently, in the US at least, the courts have been very strong defenders of the right to anonymous speech. But ACTA draft includes this fun tidbit. Each party shall enable rights holders who have given effective notification to an online service provider of materials that they claim with valid reasons to be infringing their copyright or related rights to expeditiously obtain from that provider on the information on the identity of the relevant subscriber. So all they have to do is go to an ISP saying, this person is infringing on my copyright. Please give me his name and address and phone number. And the ISP goes, looks pretty valid to me. Here's all his information. He has no privacy. This opens the flood doors for anybody, taking anybody to court for things that they don't agree with are criticisms of what somebody's doing. Nobody would be able to speak out against any corporations or against the government because they have no right to anonymity. The free speech would be shut down. Anonymous free speech would be shut down on the internet. It goes on. In other words, as long as somebody makes a copyright claim, bogus or not, I guess as long as it says valid reasons, as long as the ISP thinks it's right, and who is the ISP to judge that, ISP should be required to give up who the user is. Once again, this appears to be contrary to U.S. law. The RIAA made this argument in the U.S. years ago, and Verizon fought back and eventually won, as judges noted that ISPs did not just have to hand over information without a lawsuit being filed and an official subpoena issued. So much for ACTA not changing the U.S. law, right? Because during the ACTA debates, if you listen to them, all the countries vehemently denied that the ACTA would change any laws in their country. And this is just proving to the contrary. A lot of the stuff in ACTA is going against laws in various countries and will change them. Otherwise, they can't agree to the ACTA text. It doesn't make any sense. Of course, they keep on denying that any of these leaks are real, or they won't speak to them. They don't say they're not real. They just won't speak to any leaks. And of course, they won't show us the text as well. And it says, goes on, but even a bigger concern may be how other countries implement this as well. We've already noted that China will likely use ACTA as a justification for greater censorship. But Moshirina points out that authoritarian regimes may start abusing it to unveil anonymous internet users as well. Let's say I'm an oppressive regime. One of the very few ways my citizens can reach me is by videotaping and publicizing my brutal methods of silencing protesters. Now, not only can I use bogus takedown requests to pull down these videos, think global DMCA, but I can also get the private information of the poster. So why is anyone supporting ACTA again? It concludes with, why is anybody supporting ACTA? Because it's a great tool to take down opposing viewpoints that other people don't like. No, the corporations and the government have no interest in anonymous speech because they never make anonymous speech. They're very public about the stuff that they say, and the stuff they don't want to say, they just don't say. So, who's for anonymous speech online? The common man. So, hopefully you as the common person out there oppose ACTA and act against it whenever the opportunity arises to speak to your representatives of government and show them how dangerous this is for the common person. Copyright news from the U.S. Clipping our own wings. Copyright and creativity in communication research. Descended by DC. This is not necessarily a story, but it highlights some dangers of copyright. Communication scholars need access to copyrighted material and need to make unlicensed uses of them in order to do research, and often, especially within the United States, have the legal right to do so. But all too often they find themselves thwarted. A survey of communication scholars' practices conducted by the Ad Hoc Committee on Fair Use and Academic Freedom on the International Communications Association, a lot of acronyms there, reveals that copyright ignorance and misunderstanding hamper distribution of finished work, derail work in progress, and more seriously, lead communication researchers simply to avoid certain kinds of research altogether. Nearly half the respondents expressed a lack of confidence about their copyright knowledge in relation to their research. Nearly a third avoided research subjects or questions, and a full fifth abandoned research already underway because of copyright concerns. In addition, many ICA members have faced resistance from publishers, editors, and university administrators when seeking to include copyrighted works in their research. Scholars are sometimes forced to seek copyright holders' permission to discuss or criticize copyrighted works. Such permission seeking puts copyright holders in a position to exercise veto power over the publication of research, especially research that deals with contemporary or popular media. This is a very interesting study about how copyright is now stifling innovation in the research field. Now, this has obvious spillover into copyright stifling innovation in the creative media market. Now, copyright extension proponents always trot out that say that copyright encourages innovation by being original and by not building on old information and old ideas, but they don't realize that everything is built on old ideas. By building upon the backs of others, by building on others' innovations and others' creativity to create something yet again that's new and innovative. Imagine if you had to write a book with words that nobody else has written. Now, Lewis Carroll has done very well in that field, but imagine if you had to do it, and if you had to start from scratch and not be able to reference other people's works. How do you make any kind of literary references in your books or movies of anything done in the past 70 years without being able to reference those materials? How do you stay relevant and be able to talk about things that have happened in the last century without being afraid of being attacked by the copyright holders? And with people just don't understand how copyright works and where the line for fair use crosses over into litigation, where the copyright holders can take you to court. So people are either really going extreme on the either ends of the spectrum. where somebody is doing using creative works where they're going on the end of the spectrum, where they're either saying it's a free-for-all and just saying, forget it, I'm not going to even do any research and I just don't care about the copyright works, or they're going on the other end of the spectrum saying, I have no idea where the fair use line is, and I'm going to have to err on the side of being completely paranoid about copyright and really either not work on my creative pursuits or pare them down to something that is bland and uninteresting or something that really strays from the original vision that the artist really wants to get across. So you can see in this study, and you look on how this is affecting our state of mind in terms of copyright. So you can see the great divide opening up now, where people that have it on their mind about the copyright, about copyright infringement, are going to one extreme or the other. And I think that divide is going to get more and more, and the younger generations are going to go on the side more of just forgoing any concern about copyright whatsoever, because it's just way too complicated to figure out, and they just don't care. They just do not care anymore, and they don't see how it really applies to anything nowadays. Privacy news from the U.S. New Jersey Supreme Court upholds privacy of personal emails accessed at work. Sent in by DC, a company should not have read emails a former employee wrote to her lawyer from a private, password-protected web account, even though she sent them from her employer's computer, according to state Supreme Court ruling today that attorneys said could influence workplace privacy rules across the country. Congratulations. This is great news that Big Brother, as soon as you step through the doors at your work, doesn't mean they have access to everything that you can see, hear, or read. The precedent-setting ruling upheld the sanctity of attorney-client privilege in electronic communications between a lawyer and a nursing manager at the Loving Care Agency. After the manager quit and filed a discrimination and harassment lawsuit against the Bergen County Home Health Care Company in 2008, Loving Care retrieved the messages from the computer's hard drive and used them in preparing its defense. The unanimous decision by the state's higher court will have broader implications in workplaces, which increasingly rely on email and on the internet, according to litigators on both sides of the case. Though disappointed, the state's highest court did not rule in Loving Care's favor. The company attorney and former Supreme Court Justice Peter Verino said the decision will be helpful to companies and employers in the future. The court has now clarified an area of law, and anytime you have a court clarifying an area of law, it's a positive development, Verino said. He noted no top court in any other state has yet taken up the issue. Now, I see the issue as two different distinct things here. One is the right to privacy in the workplace on your personal communications, in terms of, like, say, your cell phone or overhearing conversations privately between you and another person, or communications on the internet. Just because it's the internet doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all at work. And the other issue is using companies' materials for personal use. Now, they could have said, don't use the computers for personal use. Either do it at lunchtime somewhere else, do it off the company grounds, or do it after work or before work, but you can't do it at work. Now, I can see that. That makes sense. But being able to pry into their private communications just because you're on the company time doesn't mean they have full access to everything you say, you read, you communicate with privately with other people. It is not a free-for-all for privacy abuse just because you're under their employ. It doesn't make any sense to open up somebody's private materials just because you happen to be in that location. It's like going to a private company, say you're you're a customer walking into a store, and because you're in their realm, they can just have a free-for-all. They can eavesdrop on your communications if you're talking on a cell phone in a mall or something. No, that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any common sense that just because you happen to be in a certain area, they get to violate your privacy rights. It doesn't make any sense, and I'm glad this passed through, and it's a great decision by the courts. In copyright news from Spain, this is another case of government hypocrisy, and well, just a hypocrisy in effect here. Piracy rampant among Spanish government officials, sent in by DC. Spain is considered to be a safe haven for operators of file-sharing-oriented websites. Courts have repeatedly ruled that if they don't profit directly from infringements, such sites fall within the boundaries of the law. In an attempt to change the situation, the Spanish government has been working on new legislation under which sites offering links to copyrighted works could be taken offline within days of a complaint. The change in law has been pushed for by entertainment industries that claim to be hit hard by the rampant piracy in Spain. The piracy rate has reached a level where movie companies are even considering putting a halt to selling DVDs in Spain, claiming it's just not worth the effort because piracy is baked into Spain's culture. Indeed, many Spaniards consider casual downloading of copyrighted music and movies as an acquired right, and thus far they have had the law on their side. Even if the newly proposed anti-piracy legislation passed, it is highly doubtful that downloading habits will change. At the Ministry of Culture, where the new legislation is being prepared, employees are still downloading as if nothing is about to change. Data gathered by the Spanish TV channel VEO7 revealed at the Ministry of Culture several employees have been downloading music and TV series without consent from copyright holders. According to the report, their ministries of defense and education are the most active file sharers, with employees using file sharing applications to download erotic calendars, music, movies, and lots of other goods. In other government bodies, staff members have also been caught red-handed while sharing copyrighted files, including the presidency, where a brain training game was downloaded without authorization. Now, this just shows more and more people's attitude towards non-monetary copyright infringement, even within the government itself. And this just shows that there needs to be a new way of making money off of your media. The attitude towards copyright infringement has changed in the world. And the laws are not going to be able to change people's attitudes. And they're going to push more and more, as you see in Britain, and now they're pushing it in Spain. They're trying to change the people's minds by legislating away people's attitude towards copyright infringement, and it's not going to work. It's already taken hold. People don't respect copyright infringement anymore. They don't respect copyright anymore. You're going to have to find a new model of way of making money from your media goods, from music, from movies. People are still going to the theater. People are still seeing concerts. There are models to make money. Don't try and cut off people's internet access or throw them in jail or fine them for non-commercial use of copyrighted materials. It's just not going to work. You're just making a nation of criminals, a world of criminals. Of free speech news from Canada, Supreme Court wades into internet speech debate with hyperlinks case, sent in by Mind Inversion. The Supreme Court of Canada, in one of its first cases dealing with the spread of information on the internet, will decide whether the everyday practice of hyperlinking can expose a writer to a lawsuit if a linked article is defamatory. This case affects almost everybody on the internet because the internet works by linking from website to website to website, said David Feuer, the director of Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic. The court, without giving reasons, agreed Thursday to hear an appeal from a Vancouver businessman, Wayne Crooks, who alleges that the writer John Newton defamed him by linking to a reputation-smearing articles in 2006 post about free speech on his website, p2pnet.net. Crooks, a former campaign organizer and financial backer of the Green Party of Canada, lost in the BC Court of Appeal, which upheld a trials judge's conclusion that hyperlinks are akin to footnotes and do not constitute republication. The hyperlinked blog relates to Crook's role in the Green Party. Newton did not repeat the content, nor did he include any comments about the links. Crooks contends that Newton, by creating the hyperlinks, then refusing to remove them when advised that they were libelous, became the publisher by his inaction. Given that Mr. Newton didn't break the hyperlink and continued to act as a chain of publication, Mr. Crooks is taking the position before the court that he is in fact republishing the defamation, said Dermon Travis, a spokesman for Crooks, owner of the company West Coast Title Search. The BC Supreme Court rejected Crook's challenge in a 2008 ruling that noted that there is no way of knowing whether readers even clicked on the links. The purpose of a hyperlink is to direct the reader to additional material from a different source, said the decision. The only difference is the ease in which a hyperlink allows the reader, with a simple click of the mouse, to instantly access the additional material. The Supreme Court has touched on online communications in a few other cases, including a recent ruling that gave journalists and bloggers stronger protection against defamation suits by creating a new offense. The Crooks case, however, will be the first direct pronouncement on internet freedom of speech, said Michael Geist, a University of Ottawa law professor who specializes in the internet. The notion that someone might be considered a publisher by merely linking to somebody else's content, I think, could potentially have huge chilling effect, and for that reason alone is going to have a major impact on the shape of the internet in Canada, said Geist. He noted that a 14-year law in the US grants immunity for hyperlinks, and he said that Canada should introduce a similar legislation so that consequences of defamatory speech rests with those who are directly responsible. And I do agree with Michael Geist in this case, because he's not publishing, the person who put up the hyperlink is not publishing the material. Is Google going to be taken to court for every website that they link and they spider because that they point to that website that could contain defamatory material? What if a website that I link to from one of my websites all of a sudden changes the material on their website, and I've been hyperlinking to it, and somebody does a search and looks for every hyperlink going to that webpage and takes everybody to court just because you have linked to that website? That doesn't make a lot of sense. And so hopefully this does not make it any further, and they stick with their original decision. In patent news from the US, IBM breaks OSS patent promise and targets mainframe emulator, sent in by Mind Inversion. IBM is threatening to pursue legal action against Turbo Hercules, a company that sells services relating to the open source Hercules project, an emulator that allows conventional computers with mainstream operating systems to run software that is designed for IBM System Z mainframe hardware. In a letter that IBM mainframe CTO Mark Anzani recently sent to Turbo Hercules, Big Blue says that it has substantial concerns that the Hercules project infringes on its patents. The letter is a brusque half page, but was sent with 9 additional pages that list a non-exhaustive selection of patents that IBM believes are infringing by the open source emulator. This move earned the scorn of well-known free software advocate and patent reform activist Florian Mueller. In a blog entry that was posted Tuesday, Mueller fiercely criticized IBM, accusing the company of abusing its patent portfolio and harming open source software in order to retain monopolistic control over its expensive mainframe offerings. After years of pretending to be a friend of free and open source software, IBM now shows its true colors. IBM breaks the number one taboo of the FOSS community and shamelessly uses its patents against well-respected FOSS project, wrote Mueller. This proves that IBM's love for free and open source software ends where its business interests begin. He contends that IBM's support for open source software is insincere. As evidence of the company's hypocrisy, Mueller points out that 2 of the patents that IBM listed in its letter Hercules are included of the list of 500 patents that IBM promised to not assert against open source software in 2005. Mueller is convinced that the patent promise was a manipulative attempt to placate government regulators. So, big surprise, another company is acting upon its best interest in monetary gain by going after a competitor where it initially promised not to. So they always say that. You always see this. Oh, those rules are in place. I know they look bad now, but we promise never ever to use them for evil. I mean, I know they're in there. They're just in there. We don't need to have them in there. And you know, these companies as well take out patents. They say that they're not going to use these patents against anyone. Well, why are you taking out the patents in the first place? And they'll say, well, we're taking out the patents so nobody else can go against open source software, or that so nobody goes against us when we want to use these innovations in software. And so it's just another use of patent abuse for something that it really shouldn't be used for. And they're obviously going against what they once said, but really, what is a company? A company is an ever-changing thing that is headed up by whoever at the time. They may have said something in one respect, 10, 20 years ago, even a year ago, but the hierarchy inside the company changes, and attitudes change as well, and stock prices change as well. So, you know, attitudes will reflect that as things change within the companies. Copyright news from the U.S. Photographers sue Google over book projects. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Google's efforts to build a vast digital library and sell books online appear to take another hit after a group representing photographers filed a lawsuit claiming the internet search giant's protected infringements on its copyrights. A project infringed on its copyrights. On Wednesday, the American Society of Media Photographers, as well as several other trade groups, filed a lawsuit in New York federal court claiming the search giant's proposed library would rob them of compensation. The ASMP was joined by four other visual artist groups, as well as several individual photographers and illustrators. We are seeking justice and fair compensation for visual artists whose work appears in the 12 million books and other publications Google has illegally scanned to date, the ASMP General Counsel Victor Perlman said in a statement. In doing so, we are giving voice to thousands of disenfranchised creators of visual artworks whose rights we hope to enforce through this class action. The photographer's lawsuit is the latest example of Google encountering pushback from copyright owners who claim its library plans infringe on their intellectual property. In 2005, groups representing authors and publishers alleged the book search project violated their copyrights, though they eventually struck a settlement in 2008. That deal still requires approval from a U.S. district court judge. Google spokesman Gabriel Stricker said in a statement, the company was confident that Google Books is fully compliant with U.S. and international copyright law. James McGuire, partner and Mishkan Deriva, New York, counsel to ASMP, said his clients filed the lawsuit after the request to be recognized as part of the text author's class action lawsuit was denied. The plaintiffs asked the court to ban Google from digitizing, displaying, and distributing selling any visual works in books or periodicals the company digitizes. The lawsuit also seeks at least $150,000 in statutory damages for each instance in which Google infringes on plaintiffs' copyrights. But at least one legal scholar expressed skepticism about the strength of the lawsuit, noting that Google has focused on scanning words rather than illustrations in works it has digitized. Google does not make available any of the visual material that might be in the books unless the copyright holder has agreed to it, said Pamela Samuelson, a digital copyright expert at University of California, Berkeley. I don't think this lawsuit has a good chance as the author's lawsuit. So very interesting things going on with the Google scanning the books. It's a very interesting thing that's happening with Google that's amassing pretty much the world's information in one place in terms of, you know, mapping the world, digitizing the books, mapping the internet in terms of text searches. They're really trying to bring the world, the whole world, sum of knowledge and putting it online. Now, the way they go about it can be questionable in terms of privacy and in terms of the rights of the people who own this, the images and text and books and music and because they own YouTube as well, so the visual works and everything. It's almost as if they have to step on people's toes to enable to get these works online. Now it's almost acting like a benevolent dictator in this case. Now, whether that's the ends justify the means, it's hard to say at this point because their motto is do no evil. Will they do evil in the end by amassing all this information? What will they do in the end of it? Right now they offer for free and provide advertising to pay their costs. So it's very interesting to watch how Google manipulates and maneuvers around the legal recourses of how they're able to access and distribute this data online. Because, you know, sometimes you really get your fist up against Google and what they're doing in terms of privacy violations of the common person and holding your personal data if you use them for your email, your documents, and then they go and provide the world's knowledge for free on the internet by digitizing books of public domain resources and just giving access to everybody. Everything. So it's a thing of give and take with Google, and it's very interesting to watch how Google operates in this realm. Now, some Pirate Party news. Pirate Party listed in Time's top 10 alternative political movements. Very fluffy piece, and the picture they used is some people on a raft, and it doesn't really cast the Pirate Party in an extremely positive light, but it does give some publicity, especially in the U.S., as this is a U.S., mainly U.S. publication, where the Pirate Party is not really a well-known party yet, as it is in the European Union. Anyway, this is sent in by Anthony. This was linked off Pirate Party Canada person. This party would, and it says in the article, this party would be way more fun if their platform were built around parrots, peg legs, and snarls of R. But the Pirate Party has won plenty of adherence with its demands for copyright and patent law reforms and fierce advocacy of privacy rights. Started by computer nerds in Sweden in 2006, it is now the country's third largest party by membership. Copyright groups have grown up in 33 countries, given rise to the umbrella organization Pirate Parties International. So not too bad. A little fluffy at the beginning of the paragraph there, but it does cast in quite a positive light. The picture's a little bit, you know, iffy, but it's exposure, and it's good, decent exposure. Pirate Party UK announces parliamentary candidates. So people in the UK, pay attention. Pirate Party UK is pleased to announce its lineup of parliamentary candidates for this year's general election. The party intends to put forward a total of 10 candidates across England and Scotland. Andrew Robinson, the party leader, said, "We have a strong team who want to stand up for your rights, for your freedoms, and for your interests. But we desperately need to raise funds. This is the only chance we have in the next few years to get our voices heard. Help us get these candidates on the ballot papers." And I give a link on the Pirate Party forums, or you can just head over to the Pirate Party UK site, and you can see if there's somebody in your riding that you can vote for and help out. Now, the closing track, I'm going to leave you with a fun little song that tries to disassociate the word copying from the word theft, because they're very often associated with each other when the media corporations are talking about copyright infringements. They always use the word theft, as if something's being taken away from them when some people make a copy. The write-up on the website says, "Question Copyright's first minute meme is a response to messages that have been tried to convince people that copying information is the same as stealing property, when it's an entirely different and generally positive thing. Until the air is cleared on that point, it's hard to have any kind of useful conversation about copying, sharing, copyright, or licensing. The purpose of these minute memes is to give educators and commentators more tools to help clear the air. Copying is not theft. Conveys its simple idea with a catchy tune, clever lyrics, and delightful animation by Nina Paley. Many thanks to Nick Phelps and Connie Champagne for a terrific soundtrack. We also thank Andy Warhol Foundation for the visual arts for supporting this meme and other in a generous grant. Copying is not theft is released under Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. And it's called Copying is Not Theft. It's sent in by DC, and I give a link to it, questioncopyright.org. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, check out your local pirate party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepirateparty.radio.com, submit them through the form on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Copying is not theft. Stealing a thing leaves one less left. Copying, it makes one thing more. That's what copying's for. Copying is not theft. If I copy yours, you have it too. One for me and one for you. That's what copies can do. If I steal your bicycle, you have to take the bus. But if I just copy it, there's one for each of us. Making more of a thing, that is what we call copying. Sharing ideas with everyone, that's why copying is fun.